Hi, my name's Flo and I'm an alcoholic. And I only have three words to say tonight, and that is, oh my God. Now we can all go home. My sponsor was supposed to be here tonight to talk, and she says she's sick. And I got a call on my answering machine from Tim when I got home yesterday, and he explained the situation. And I heard that he was from the Pacific Group and that he needed a speaker tonight. And all of a sudden, I started getting chest pains and sweating between my toes. And kind of like I am now. But I was told early on, and thank God for those old timers, I was told that you do not say no to an AA request. And I was trained well, and no matter what this head tells me, you know, to do, because I think I know best, you know, I do not say no to AA request. So anyway, I called Tim back, and here I am. And I'm going to feel really good in about 45 minutes. To tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today, I was born, and and then it got worse. It's like right out of the chute there was trouble. I was born December 3rd, 1950, in Huntington Park, California. All right, one in the crowd. And I had, you know, a mother and a father back when that was normal. And I had a brother who was 2.5 years older than I was. And he was pretty much perfect, and I was always told about him growing up, you know, why can't you be like your pretty much perfect brother? And I used to say, well, because he's boring, and who wants to be perfect like that? And he's still pretty much perfect, and he's still pretty much boring. I was born with the name Flolene Arvella Harris. And I used to tell the people in the bars, if you had a name like that, you'd drink too. Growing up, I always wanted my father's approval, always wanted his love, and I never seemed to be able to get it. One thing, he never even knew how to spell my name. I mean, you know, you know, Flolene is kind of a hard name, but come on, you know, he's had 48 years to learn how to spell it. And he still doesn't know how to spell it. This father, he didn't know my birthday. You know, it was like I really didn't exist. And I always wanted his love and approval, and I just never could get it. And growing up in that house, I remember having two emotions. It was either fear or anger all the time. And they would just like pop up, and I never knew which one was going to pop up to the surface, you know. I was just always scared, or I was in this rage all the time. And if somebody would look at me cross-eyed, I would literally, you know, I would either punch them in the nose or start crying. And I never knew how I was going to react. And I was one of the little girls in grammar school getting on, you know, in fights on the playground. And I just never could control my emotions. Once I got sober and I did an inventory, I realized that basically I only had one emotion, and that was fear, and I would cover it up with all this anger, because I'd rather you see me angry than see how scared I really am. In this home, that we never had any hugs or kisses, or I never heard the words, I love you. That just wasn't done in our home, and that's just the way I was brought up. I also remember feeling always less than, never good as. I always felt uglier than, stupider than, and not as good as anybody else. And I was just scared of people, places, and things my whole life. I've heard a lot of people say at the podium they don't know why they drank. I know why I drank. I was scared to death. It was the fear where I would literally cross the street so I wouldn't have to say hi to somebody. I was just scared of people all the time. I started drinking when I was 17 years old, and it was wonderful. Before that, I couldn't talk to anybody. I never knew what to say. I was just, you know, I was like the wallflower. But then I started drinking, and it was just magic, and I loved it from the very beginning. All of a sudden, you know, it just filled all those holes, and I could talk to anybody about anything, and all of a sudden, I'm looking pretty good, you know. After a few drinks, I'm feeling, you know, pretty sexy, and all of a sudden, I'm feeling intelligent, you know. I felt like I could talk about brain surgery. You know, and I was the type of alcoholic that would dance on the tabletops, you know, once I drank. But the next day I'd go back and, you know, hide against the wall again without the alcohol. But, you know, when you find something like that that's going to do that for you, you're not going to give it up that easily. And I drank as long as I could. I ended up drinking 10 years, and I believe it was from, you know, it was alcoholically from the very beginning. I never drank socially. When I got to AA and they talked about social drinking, I thought that was when a whole bunch of people got together and got drunk. You know, I never drank that way. I don't know what it is to drink that way. And I remember when I had about a year of sobriety, my boss asked me to go to lunch, and he knew I was on the program. And he said, well, usually I have a drink with my lunch, but I won't today because I know it'll bother you. And I said, no, it won't. Go ahead and have a drink. And he goes, oh, no, I know it would bother you. And I said, no, go ahead and have a drink. So anyway, he ordered this drink, and all through lunch, he's sipping it, and he's putting it down, and he's sipping it, and he's putting it down, and he's sipping it, and he's putting it down. And I can't pay attention to word he's saying because I'm just amazed how many sips he can get out of this little baby glass. And when it's time to leave, he still has that much left in the glass. I know. And then when we stood up to leave, I said, you know what really bothers me is the fact we're going to leave and you're not going to drink that. And he says, well, alcohol does have calories in it. And they lock people like us up. You know, I don't understand that drinking at all, you know. You know, even today, if I'm watching TV and there's a couple on TV and they're trying to be romantic and they have the champagne bottle and these little baby champagne glasses, you know, and they take a couple of sips out of the little baby champagne glasses, and then they go in the other room and do whatever they're going to do in there. You know, I want to yell at the TV set, take the bottle with you. You know, that stuff kind of, it still bothers me, you know. Because when I drank, I knew where my drink was, I knew where your drink was, and if you left it unattended, it was gone. Used to go out dancing with my girlfriends, and they would get up and dance, and I would drink everybody's drink at the table, and then they'd come back and say, where'd the drink go? And I'd say, did the drinks go? And I'd say, well, I don't know. And that's just the type of alcoholic I am. I remember my first sponsor, she used to say, honey, you were a hog out there while you were drinking, be a hog in here in sobriety. And that's what I've been trying to do so far, and it's worked out pretty good. I was the type of drinker where once I drank, I never went home at night. And I was still living at home, and Dad didn't like that too much. He didn't understand about me. He accused me of sleeping around town when, in fact, I was passing out around town. And he didn't understand that about passing out around town. And it was a year or so after that he asked me to leave and to move. And so I got an apartment by myself, and I thought, good, now nobody's going to be there to watch me, and I'm going to really be able to drink the way I want. But the only problem is when nobody's there to watch me, I don't drink well at all. I want a drink in the morning. You know, that thought hits me to have a drink in the morning, and I have to do it. You know, way back then, I was powerless over alcohol, and I lost a lot of jobs that way. I was never fired or anything. I just would wake up in the morning and, you know, think about having a drink, and I'd have to get one, and I would never go back to work. But there's one thing about alcoholics. We seem to be able to get jobs pretty fast, and I never had trouble getting a job. I believe that alcoholics usually can do the work of three people. We have to, because we're usually only there 3-4 days a week. And so I never had trouble getting jobs. I started working at this trucking company, and I started dating the terminal manager. He was about 15 years older than I was, and he looked like a bald-headed buzzard. And we started dating alcoholically. I don't know how you dated alcoholically, but the way we dated was one night he would beat me up, and the next night I'd beat him up. And we dated that way for about a year. And you know, ladies, you know, you get those black eyes and, you know, those scratches and scrapes and sprained elbows and stuff, and, you know, those things just happen. But you have to go to work, and they want to know what happened to you, and you really don't know. But, you know, you have to make up stories and say, oh, yeah, I tripped over the dog's toy, or, oh, yeah, he elbowed me in my sleep. And, you know, you have to make up all these stories because, you know, they might think something's wrong with him for doing that to you, but they might think something's wrong with you for putting up with it. So you have to hide it and not tell anybody. And, ladies, I'm happy to report I got my licks in there, too. I remember one night we were in the living room, and after about three drinks, I went into a blackout. And the next thing I know, I'm in the closet on top of him, choking him to death. And I don't know what he did. But and you can't say, by the way, what did you do? And I don't know what he did, but I'm sure he deserved it. And, you know, and we just live that way. You know, that was normal life. You know, it talks about in the big book, you know, after a while we think that our alcoholic life is normal, you know, and it just seemed real normal and natural. After dating like this for about a year, we decided to go to Vegas and get married. Because, ladies, you know, when you have a gem like that, all the other women want him. So we have to marry him. So we got married in Vegas, and we were both drinking. God knows I couldn't have married him sober. But we got married and then decided to, I was going to quit my job and stay home and be Susie Homemaker, and that was a total disaster. He accused me of hiding dirty dishes under the bed. And things like that. But the drinking just progressed. All of a sudden, he had a gun, and he kept on threatening me with a gun that if I didn't mind, or if I didn't do what he wanted me to do, he was going to kill me, and, you know, stuff like that, normal stuff like that. And it just got worse and worse, and I would leave him, and I would go back, and I would leave him, and I'd go back, and then after about being married about, I think it was like 10 months, he got really sick, and all of a sudden he's not picking fights with me anymore. And he went to the doctor, and they told him he had sugar diabetes and that he couldn't drink anymore. And he came home and he says, I can't drink anymore. And I said, well, that's too bad. And he says, well, I don't want you to drink anymore either. And I said, uh-uh, I don't have diabetes. And all of a sudden, this obsession I had for this man was like lifted. And I left him, and I never did go back. I moved in with my mom. God bless mothers, you know. If it weren't for mothers, we'd probably get here a lot sooner. She let me move in there, and I wasn't working, and I was just drinking around the clock. It was just one big drunken mess, you know, and all of a sudden I'm not dancing and on the tables, I'm not going to the bars and all that stuff. I'm just drinking in bed. And, you know, if you got to throw up, you just throw up and roll over. And that was the way I was living. This soon-to-be ex-husband came over one night, and he said that he worked with a man who used to be a really bad drunk, and now this man goes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's living a pretty good life. And he said that he told this man about me, and that the man said, well, why don't you invite her to a meeting? And he wanted to know if I wanted to go to a meeting. And he caught me on a very bad day, which was a good day for me. I was very hungover, and it's a type of hangover that you have when you're laying on a couch, and if you move your eyeballs too fast to one side, you feel like your head's gonna split open. And that was the kind of day I was having, and he wanted to know if I wanted to go to a meeting, and I said, yeah, I'll go. You know, if you want to get somebody to come to an AA meeting, talk to them when they're hungover. And I went to my first meeting, and I don't know what you thought about your first meeting, but I thought it was the strangest, most bizarrest thing I ever been to. These people got up to the podium, and they would talk about this higher power and this spiritual program, and then they'd start cussing like a sailor. And then they talk about God working in their lives, and then they start cussing again, and I thought, man, this is weird. This wasn't like the churches I'd gone to. It was weird, but I liked it. And I'll never forget, there was one lady that got up to the podium, and she said when she drank, she used to live next to the La Brea tar pits. And she used to throw her empty booze bottles in the tar pits. And she said that she was always afraid that those booze bottles were going to come to the surface and the cops were going to come and get those booze bottles and get her fingerprints off the booze bottles and come get her. And I thought, man, I'm not that bad. But after that first meeting, it was like, I couldn't drink in ignorance anymore. I knew what I was. But I didn't think my case was as bad as yours. You know, my case was different. I'm unique. I don't have to do all those other things that those people in those meetings were doing. And so, you know, I tried an easier, softer way, and I tried every single thing I could think of to stop drinking in 2.5 years, and nothing worked. You know, I tried the churches and the psychics and the faith healers and self-hypnosis and every single thing I could think of, and nothing worked. And I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 2.5 years, more out than in. But I'd come late, sit in the back. I got a big book, and I went home one night, and I took all the steps, you know, in one night. And I thought, wow, that's not that bad. I don't know what the big deal is. And I was just went in and out, until I couldn't do it anymore. And I just got sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I was at the jumping off point where I didn't, you know, something had to happen. It was either I was going to have to try to get sober or I was going to kill myself. I just couldn't stand it another day. Christmas Eve night, had a boyfriend over. This was a little over 21 years ago. I had this boyfriend over. He came over to see me, and I was drunk, and he wanted to leave, and I didn't want him to leave. And so I remember getting down on the floor, and I'm holding his leg, you know, in my hands, and I'm grabbing onto his leg so he wouldn't leave me. And that's really sexy move, you know. But you know, he kind of just shook my hands loose and walked out the door. And I'm happy to report, in the 21 years I've been sober, I haven't had to hold anybody like that in sobriety. But anyway, he walked out that night, and I decided to call central office and, you know, tell the guy at central office my problems. And this is around midnight. And I talked to him on the phone, and I was drunk, and I was telling him all my problems, and he was listening. And he said that he would have a lady call me back that lived in my area. And I said, okay. And when we were ready to hang up, I remember I said, I love you. And I'm sure he was impressed with that. But he had this lady call me back, and They say when the pupil's ready, the teacher will appear. And she was my teacher. Her name was Ruth Mathis. And she lived in Bellflower. And she called me back. And at that time, she had 17 years of sobriety. And I remember talking to her on the phone and her telling me that. And I went, ooh, and ah. Like, you know, I thought she wanted me to be impressed. But I wasn't impressed with 17 years. I would have been impressed with 17 days. You know, I would have understood that. But 17 years, come on. She probably didn't remember how it felt to be drunk, I thought. But anyway, I started going to meetings with her, and she knew everybody. She was like this big circuit speaker, and she knew everybody, and she wanted to sit up. She wanted to come to meetings early and sit up front. And she'd say, come on, honey, let's sit up front and see the whites of their eyeballs. And I didn't want to sit up front, but I had to because I was afraid to go to meetings by myself. So I would come with her, and she would introduce me to everybody as her Christmas Eve baby. She'd say, honey, come on over here and meet my Christmas Eve baby. And everybody come over and look at me. And and I would feel so stupid. And she was just so proud of the fact I was her Christmas Eve baby. She told everybody that I just didn't have enough nerve to tell her I was still drinking. And when, you know, when they think you're sober, they expect you to get chips. So I had to get up and get my 30-day chip and my 90-day chip, and I'm still drinking. And I remember I talked to Big Book 10 minutes one night, and I told everybody I had 3 months, and I probably had about 3 days. I think I gave a pretty good pitch that night. But anyway, if you're doing something like that, if you're lying about your sobriety, either two things will happen. Either you'll get honest or you'll get drunk. And I got drunk. And it was a 4-day drunk. And it was not a fun drunk. You know, they say it's important to remember your last drink, or maybe you haven't had it. But it was nothing. It was not exciting at all. I had my mom come over and stay with me because I was afraid people were, I thought somebody was going to come through the window and murder me. And just complete paranoia. But I had my mom come over, stay with me. And at that time, my sponsor had given me some AA speaker tapes. So I sat there drunk with my mom, listening to AA speaker tapes. Now, if I ever think that there's any more fun in that bottle, I just remember that last drunk. That was pretty pathetic. I had my mom call my sponsor to tell her I was drinking. And my mom called Ruth, and my mom says, yeah, Flo's drinking. She's having some boyfriend trouble. And my mom goes, oh, okay, I'll tell her. And she hangs up the phone, and my mom goes, Ruth says you're not drinking because of the boyfriend. She says you're drinking because you're an alcoholic and you're not working your program. And it was like, oh, my God, that was my moment of clarity. It wasn't because of the way I was raised. It wasn't because of those boyfriends. It wasn't those jobs. It wasn't this. It wasn't that. It's because I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not working my program. I didn't know what a program was, but it was obvious I wasn't working it. So I started going to meetings with Ruth, and I was willing to go to any lengths. You know, I was, you know, as only the dying can. I was willing to do anything that was asked of me in this program, and I was scared to death. I'd been scared all my life, and he took away my booze, and you took away my pills, and I'm scared again. But I have to do these things that I'm asked to do in here because I was afraid I might get struck drunk. And so, you know, they would ask me to, like, read something, and oh, my God. I would get up to the podium, and I would hyperventilate, and I would shake, and I didn't know if I was going to wet my pants or cry. I was just so scared, and when I would finally get done, I'd almost get a standing ovation, because everybody knew how hard it was for me to do that. Just that fear, all that time, that consuming fear, all the time, and my sponsor used to say, honey, you better get your eyes off your belly button, because that's all I ever did was think about me all the time. You know, I'd sit in the meeting while it was going on and think, oh my God, what if nobody talks to me after the meeting? Or what if they talk to me after the meeting? What am I going to say? You know, I didn't know what to say to anybody. So that's what I thought about all through the meeting. I remember people would say, you know, just be yourself and we love you. We'll love you anyway. And I just wanted to grab them by the shirt and say, well, tell me who I am and I'll be that person. You know, I had no clue who I was. I remember when I was new, I heard all the women say that they came to AA and they learned to act like a lady. They learned to act like a lady. Everywhere I went, I heard that, you know, that they came here and to learn to act like a lady. And I finally said to my, and that didn't sound like a good idea to me. Because my idea of a lady was somebody with a little patent leather purse and little patent leather shoes, kind of like I have on tonight. And going to Sunday school on Sundays, you know. And I finally said to my sponsor, you know, do I have to act like a lady? And she said, hell no, honey. She says, you've been acting all your life. You just learn to be flow and that'll be good enough. And that's what I've done so far and it has been good enough. I remember when I had a couple years of sobriety, I went to a participation meeting and they asked me to get up and talk and I was so scared. And when I get scared, I don't know about you, but when I get scared, it's just like somebody takes a hose, vacuum cleaner hose, and sticks it on my mouth and sucks all the saliva right out of my mouth. And I was so nervous and I was trying to talk and my lips were sticking to my gums. And I wanted to say I never felt a part of, and it came out, I never farted. Well, I never have, but that's not what I wanted to say. And they laughed and laughed and, oh. You know, I always wanted to be cool. I always wanted you to think I was hip, slick, and cool, and I've never been able to pull it off. You know exactly what's going on the outside. You know, it's all right there. When I was like 6 months sober, I decided to do my inventory. My sponsor had told me that, and I don't know if this is true, but she said that they had took a survey on 100 people that had gone out, you know, that had gone back out after they came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and one thing they all had in common, none of them had done a fourth and fifth step. So that scared me. And so I started to do it. I did it. And I was doing my fourth step, and Ruth used to say, honey, you better make sure you put some good stuff in that, you know, good things that you did in that inventory, and just don't list all the bad stuff you did. And I said, you know what? I can't think of one good thing I've ever done. And she says, honey, she says, God hasn't put a person on this earth that hasn't put some good in them, and you better start looking for the good in you. And I said, okay. So I went home and I tried to think of something good and I could not think of one good thing I'd ever done in my whole life that I could put in this inventory. And I went back to her and I said, you know what? There's nothing good I can put in this inventory. And she said, oh, she said, okay, when you were a child, did you have dolls? I said, yes. She says, did you play good with your dolls? And I said, no. I used to take their clothes off and whip them. She said, I give up, just start writing. So anyway, I wrote my inventory and I called her up and I finally had it done and she said, okay, come on over. And it took like 4 hours to read it to her. And I would be reading, and she'd get a phone call, and I'd stop, you know. And she'd say, oh, honey, I got to answer this phone, but don't you stop reading. You keep on reading. And then she'd come and sit back down again, and then she'd say, honey, I got to go to the bathroom, but don't you stop reading. You keep on reading. And I'm starting to think, wow, I could throw anything in here, and she wouldn't even know, and it would be legal. And then she would come back and then the phone would ring and this went on for like 4 hours. I know why she did it. We would have probably still been there if I'd stopped reading every time she got a call. But I got to this one point in my inventory and I told her, I said, okay, this is the worst thing that's ever happened in my whole life, that it is the most embarrassing thing that I've ever done and I'm so humiliated and it happened 7 years ago and every time I think about it, my stomach gets into a knot. And she said, okay. So I read it, and she just started laughing. And before I knew it, I started laughing, you know? And all of a sudden, the deepest, darkest secret I had was put into the sunlight, and it wasn't, you know, there was no boogeyman there, you know? It was funny, you know? And she always gave everything the light touch. When I turned 3 years sober on this program, I turned 30 years old, and I was single, and I thought, I'm running out of time. My biological clock is ticking away, and I'm running out of time. And so I thought that, you know, God needed some help. And so I decided to meet Boy Meets Girl on AA campus. And I decided to look for Mr. Wright in AA meetings. In that 1 year, I found about 10 of them. Not all at once. But I'd be madly in love with one week, and then the next week, he made me sick. And then I'd be madly in love with another one the next week, and the next week, I couldn't stand him. And that's just the way it went on the whole year, until I found a newcomer. And I convinced him he was in love, and I got pregnant, and we got married. And 6 weeks later, I couldn't stand him. And so I left. And I know that's not a record in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's pretty close. And it was really hard coming to the meetings and being pregnant and, you know, what's his name's not with me. And people would say, oh, where is Don tonight? And I'd say, I don't know. And as time got progressed and it got, you know, I got bigger and I got bigger and my stomach got bigger, I felt like I had this neon sign flashing off and on, mistake, mistake, mistake. Because I had 3 years of sobriety and I thought I knew what was happening and I had my act together. And then some of the ladies came up to me in the meetings and they say, oh, you're pregnant. And I said, no, I just have cirrhosis of the liver. And it was really a difficult time for me, but for the grace of God, I stayed sober and I continued to go to meetings. And as time got closer and closer for my daughter to be born, I realized I never even babysat. I didn't know how to change a diaper. And I asked an AA friend that was like an AA brother to me if he would go to those Lamaze classes with me. And he said, yeah. So we went to the Lamaze classes and we learned all the pushing and the breathing and all that stuff. So the night my daughter was born, she was breached, so I had to have a cesarean. But because he had gone to those classes with me, he was able to be there in the operating room and hold my hand when my daughter was born. And talk about a neat experience, you know, to have a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous hold your hand. And my daughter was born, and the doctor says, congratulations, you have a baby girl. And I just laid there and cried. And I said, thank you, God, thank you. And I remember one of the doctors said to me, well, don't you think you ought to thank Dr. So-and-so? He had something to do with it, too. And my AA friend said, they'll never understand. But I was just so glad to have a little girl. I wanted a girl so bad that I thought for sure God would give me a stinky little boy. And that little baby girl, she's beautiful. She'll be 17 years old next month, and she's the best thing that's happened to me in my sobriety, besides my sobriety. It's been such a neat experience being a sober mother and to be there for her and for her not to see me drunk and not for her to be ashamed or for me to humiliate her and to be there to go to her events that happen and you know, taking her to kindergarten that first day and all the little kids crying for their mommies and I'm crying with them, you know. And just to see her grow up and to be there for her, you know, for her to tell me she got her first kiss and she went on her first date and she's definitely a byproduct of this program and I'm very proud of her. she's a good example for me how I want to be when I grow up. You know, she's the mature one in the family. Recently, I have dated a couple of times, and a couple of guys asked me out. I told my daughter about it. I said, well, you know, they asked me out, but they're not really my type, and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And my daughter goes, yeah, Mom, but look where your type's gotten you. And some people go to shrinks for years to find out that. But she's just the apple of my eye, and I'm just so proud of her. She works in a convalescent home part-time and does good at school. She works at this convalescent home, and she's the activity assistant. She says, Mom, it's really neat. They pay me to play with the old folks. And she really enjoys it. Sobriety has been really good. You know, it's been really good. And I've been so blessed in so many ways. By this program. And if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't have the life I have today. Like I said, when I got sober, I couldn't hold down a job. The longest I had a job was like 3 months. Last month, I celebrated working 20 years at the company I work for. And that's not because it's a perfect job. It's just because I've learned not to run. I remember my sponsor said when I first got sober, honey, you can take your running shoes off. You're home now. There's no other place to go. You're already there. And I've tried to apply these principles in all of my affairs, you know, and in the workforce and at home, and it really has helped. My first sponsor, she passed away when I had 7 years of sobriety. She died of cancer. And she was in the hospital, and she was dying, and people would call her up on the phone to try to cheer her up, and they would end up being cheered up by her. And they would call her up on the phone and they'd ask her how she was doing, and she'd say, honey, I've never had it so good. And I want to be like her when I grow up. Her higher power was called the big boy, and that's what she called him, was the big boy. And she'd say that every morning she was all excited because she didn't know what goodies the big boy was going to bring her that day. That's the attitude I try to have, is to be excited about life because God's brought some good stuff. You know, like the 10-minute speakers before me talked about, that it's not all rosy here, it's not all wonderful. There's some things that we have to walk through, and they're painful. But what I've learned is that all the seemingly bad things that happen, there's usually some good stuff that happens at the end. There's always lessons to learn and always things to grow from. I certainly plan on coming back. And if you're new here tonight, I hope you come back too. Thank you.